For this February 4th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your late Thursday evening headlines. After a day with often fierce debate on the House floor, Democrats forcing Republicans to go on the record over past remarks by Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Tonight's vote stripping the freshman lawmaker of her committee assignments. We'll tell you how the developments are playing out in her Northwest Georgia congressional district. And all of this following last night's meeting by House Republicans, the GOP conference, by a vote of 145 to 61, agreeing to keep Representative Liz Cheney as the number three leader in the House. However, the Wyoming lawmaker is still facing a primary challenge next year. She was one of 10 House Republicans voting to impeach President Trump last month. And the lead House impeachment manager, Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, today asking the former president, Donald Trump, to provide testimony under oath either before or during his Senate trial scheduled to start next Tuesday, live on C-SPAN 2. But the president's lawyer saying that it's nothing more than a publicity stunt. He will not participate. And during his first major foreign policy speech, President Biden announcing an end to U.S. support for offensive operations in Yemen, while also ending a freeze on troop redeployments from Germany. Last year, the Trump administration announcing plans to withdraw American troops from that country. The stories shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill, where congressional Democrats taking the rare step of removing a member from the committees. With a handful of Republican votes, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was stripped of her two committee assignments, education and budget. The final vote tonight was 230 to 199, with 11 Republicans siding with the Democratic majority. Earlier today, the Georgia lawmaker speaking on the House floor for about 10 minutes. In her speech, she said that she, quote, stopped believing in QAnon sometime in 2018 after finding misinformation, lies, and things that were not true. She also walked back some previous comments suggesting that school shootings, like the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary and the 2018 Parkland shooting, were staged. She also retracted a past claim suggesting that the 9/11 terror attacks may not have occurred. More from the House floor with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene earlier today.
So when we elected President Trump, and then I started seeing things in the news that didn't make sense to me, like Russian collusion, which are conspiracy theories also, and have been proven so. These things bothered me deeply, and I realized just watching CNN or Fox News, I may not find the truth. And so what I did is I started looking up things on the internet, asking questions like most people do every day. Use Google. And I stumbled across something, and this was at the end of 2017, called QAnon. Well, these posts were mainly about this Russian collusion information. A lot of it was some of what I would see on the news at night, and I got very interested in it. So I posted about it on Facebook, I read about it, I talked about it, I asked questions about it, and then more information came from it. But you see, here's the problem. Throughout 2018, because I was upset about things and didn't trust the government, really, because the people here weren't doing the things that I thought they should be doing for us, the things that I just told you I cared about. And I want you to know, a lot of Americans don't trust our government, and that's sad. The problem with that is, though, is I was allowed to believe things that weren't true, and I would ask questions about them and talk about them. And that is absolutely what I regret, because if it weren't for the Facebook post and comments that I liked in 2018, I wouldn't be standing here today, and you couldn't point a finger and accuse me of anything wrong, because I've lived a very good life that I'm proud of, my family's proud of, my husband's proud of, my children are proud of, and that's what my district elected me for.
Those comments from freshman Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia responding. Here is Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts. He is also the chair of the House Rules Committee, explaining why Democrats decided to proceed with today's floor vote that would strip the representative from her two key committee assignments.
The party of Lincoln is becoming the party of violent conspiracy theories. And apparently the leaders of the Republican Party in the House today are not going to do a damn thing about it. Now, I never thought I would say this, Madam Speaker, but I agree with Mitch McConnell. The Senate Minority Leader this week called Congresswoman Greene's embrace of conspiracy theories, and I quote, a cancer for the Republican Party, end quote. I would take it a step further. I think giving Congresswoman Green a megaphone on a standing committee would be a cancer on this entire Congress. None of us get to decide who the voters send to Congress, but as members of this body, it is our job to set the standard for the conduct of those who serve here, especially when they cross the line into violence. The Republican talking point now seems to be, I condemn Congresswoman Green's words, but, Madam Speaker, her words are indefensible, period, and we must act. Not because it helps us or hurts them, but because it is the right thing to do for this institution and for America.
And that from Congressman Jim McGovern from today's floor debate. At one point, the representative before elected to Congress referred to Speaker Nancy Pelosi, saying that she should take, quote, a bullet to the head at her weekly news conference. This from the House Speaker.
I remain profoundly concerned about House Republicans' leadership acceptance of extreme conspiracy theorists. Particularly disturbing is their eagerness to reward a QAnon adherent, a 9/11 truther, a harasser of child survivors of school shootings, and to give them valued committee positions, including who could imagine they would put such a person on the Education Committee. Today, the House will vote to remove Representative Green from her seat on Education and Labor and the Budget Committees. It's just so unfortunate. You would think that the Republican leadership in the Congress would have some sense of responsibility to this institution, as they did when they did not seat Representative King of Iowa 2 years ago. For some reason, they have chosen not to go down that path, even though Mr. Hoyer gave the leader, McCarthy, sufficient notice that this was a path we would follow.
That earlier today from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It was last night in a closed-door meeting of the House GOP conference that Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene reportedly received a standing ovation after speaking to her Republican colleagues. And late last night, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy with these remarks.
Why did you make the decision not to remove Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene from her committee assignment?
Well, see, that's not true. I did. We were willing to remove her from Ed and Labor. And when Steny Hoyer had called me, he said that was the complaint they had. Going, and I want to be very clear, we denounce anything that we've seen that was said in that past, from anything with QAnon has no place in our party. And Marjorie Greene actually said that inside our conference today. She said it before, but she said from the shootings and everywhere else. And if that gave people problems, she's a small business owner. So we'd say budget and small business. I was more than willing to do that. The conference was willing to do that. And Steny Hoyer and the Democrats said no. They're going to judge her on things that were said that she has now denounced before she was ever a member of Congress. I just wonder if they take that same standard. Well, are they going to leave Swalwell on Homeland Security and on Intel? You know, the Speaker has that appointment. She and I were both down in the skiff, and we heard what the FBI report was. No way would I ever leave him on Intel nor Homeland. I'd question whether he should still be a member of Congress. And then you're going to look at Maxine Waters as a chair of what she incited? There are so many. I wonder if they put that same standard as someone else. Because never in the history of Congress has people been deciding where other parties are putting people on committees.
Senator McConnell said her views amount to a cancer for the Republican Party.
Well, I denounce all those comments that were brought up. Everybody, and she came to the floor, she came inside our conference and denounced them as well. She said she was wrong. She has reached out in other ways and forms, and nothing that she said has been based upon since she's been a member of Congress.
Those remarks last night by the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy following the GOP conference meeting in closed doors. And joining us on the phone from Atlanta is Greg Bluestein. He covers politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Based on all that we saw today on the House floor, where does this leave politically Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Well, in the short term, it means that she has less power to actually get anything done in Washington back home for her district. It leaves her district without a say on key committees like Education Committee and the Budget Committee that she hoped to have influence over that sort of legislation. But in the longer term, the question is still unknown because her constituents, by and large, at least the Republican activists, the movers and shakers in her Northwest Georgia territory, are standing by her, saying that she might be embarrassing, but she's their embarrassment. They own up to her. They said they supported her in the November election, and that, you know, she continues to be their representative.
And earlier today on the House floor, she made the following remarks.
You see, here's the real situation. I decided to run for Congress because I wanted to help our country. I want Americans to have our American dream. I want to protect our freedoms. This is what I ran for Congress on. I never once said during my entire campaign, QAnon, I never once said any of the things that I am being accused of today during my campaign. I never said any of these things since I have been elected for Congress.
That from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene on the House floor earlier today. Greg Bluestein, she did try to kind of walk away from some earlier comments or earlier likes that she had on social media. Will that be enough?
Yeah, she did not apologize, and she didn't walk back many of her other comments. She did say that she did not express those views on the campaign trail. What she didn't say is that she was given lots of opportunities from reporters, including me, to apologize, to walk back, to condemn some of her earlier remarks. And instead of doing so, did a lot of, you know, kind of echoed what she said today on the House floor, which is blamed the media for things that she had said.
So if we could, let's take a step back. How did she win this congressional seat?
It's an interesting story because it actually dates back to a different district. She was originally running for a moderate suburban Atlanta district. She's actually from the wealthy northern suburbs of Atlanta. She is not from anywhere close to the district where she represents now in background. She was running against Democrat Lucy McBath, and she was going to be in a competitive primary against Republican Karen Handel, a former congresswoman. And that's when Tom Graves, the longest-serving Republican member of the U.S. House in Georgia, abruptly decided to step down. She almost immediately decided to move to Northwest Georgia, a very, very conservative district, and run for the open seat there. And she had a distinct advantage in that she was able to pump about $1 million of her own money into that race, and she already had a campaign operation up and ready. All she did was kind of import it, about 100 miles northwest of where she lived. And that gave her a big advantage over a very large field of Republicans all competing for that same deeply conservative seat. She ended up almost winning the race outright. In Georgia, you need to have a majority of vote to win a nomination. She got close to it but didn't quite get there. She faced a runoff against a local neurosurgeon named John Cowan, who said that he would be conservative without the crazy. He promised to be just as conservative as Marjorie Taylor Greene, but not but without the controversial opinions and stances and history of bigoted remarks. And she ended up trouncing him in that runoff. And this is a district, again, that's so conservative that Democrats don't even usually bother to run. And in this case, the Democrat who was on the ballot ended up moving back home to the Midwest and dropping out of that race after he got a divorce proceedings. So she won it in a walk.
As you looked at today's developments, the debate on the House floor, the vote by the House of Representatives, and her remarks last night to the House GOP lawmakers, how is this story playing out in Atlanta and in her district?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because her district is, you know, is served by the Atlanta media market, but is very different. It's very distinct from the Atlanta media market. It's mostly small to mid-sized towns that doesn't have a huge newspaper or TV station that dominates the district. A lot of voters there get their news from conservative-leaning outlets, and some of them are proclaiming her kind of a conservative champion, a fighter for President Trump. Voters that we've talked to there either vary between calling her an embarrassment or calling her a champion. In metro Atlanta, she's seen very differently, because even Republicans in the metro Atlanta area are very worried about her impact going forward because Democrats are doing everything they can to paint her as the face of the Georgia Republican Party. So Republicans are worried that in 2022, she'll have a negative impact on the campaign.
A story that we will follow along with your reporting. Greg Bluestein of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, We thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also on Capitol Hill, the House Democrat leading the impeachment drive against former President Donald Trump, formally requesting that the ex-president testify under oath on his own behalf at his upcoming trial in the Senate. We, of course, will have live coverage beginning next Tuesday on C-SPAN 2. Congressman Jamie Raskin is requesting that the former president testify concerning, quote, his conduct on January 6, 2021. The Maryland congressman, by the way, is a former constitutional law professor at American University. The letter reads in part, quote, 2 days ago, you filed an answer in which you denied many factual allegations set forth in the article of impeachment. You have thus attempted to put critical facts at issue, notwithstanding the clear and overwhelming evidence of your constitutional offense. If you decline this invitation, we reserve any and all rights, including the right to establish at trial that your refusal to testify supports a strong adverse inference regarding your actions and inaction on January 6th. And in the letter, Congressman Raskin added that Trump's testimony would be subject to cross-examination. Well, that brought a response late today, the president's lawyers issuing their own letter to Congressman Raskin, calling the action nothing more than a publicity stunt, adding that the former president, quote, will not testify. Well, the January 6th uprising was behind a move by the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists to expel the former president. Trump's response was, quote, who cares? He went on to write, while I'm not familiar with your work, I'm very proud of my work. The former president listing his appearance in movies and on the NBC series The Apprentice. The resignation letter following the Screen Actors Guild voting overwhelmingly to condemn the 45th president for failing to stop the deadly violence on Capitol Hill in early January. The union's organization releasing a brief statement to the former president simply stating, thank you. And now to the Senate and the looming debate over President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. A Democratic-sponsored Senate budget resolution allows lawmakers to write and pass a major COVID relief bill with just 51 votes. Now, a reminder, the budget resolution is not the COVID relief bill. It is just the next step in a process that gives committees the ability to go on and write the COVID bill and eventually pass it with a simple majority. First, however, lawmakers will have to get through what is known as a budget votorama. We'll be live on C-SPAN 2 into the evening and tomorrow. Here is the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
Today, the Senate is going to take the next strong step forward in passing a rescue plan to lift the country out of the crisis and set it back on the path to normal. Starting this afternoon, we begin the process of debating amendments to the budget resolution. When that process is complete, at whatever hour, we'll vote on final passage and pave the way for Senate committees to begin crafting the rescue plan itself in coordination with House committees as well. The amendment process here today will be bipartisan, and it will be open, and it will be vigorous. Democrats and Republicans alike will have the opportunity to share their ideas. We welcome that. Of course, what amendments our friends in the minority propose is entirely up to them. Now, the Republican leader hinted yesterday that his conference is preparing several messaging amendments that they hope might score political points. That's fine. That's their right. But I sincerely hope our Republican colleagues approach our work today with the intention of having serious ideas considered, not using the debate over pandemic relief to sharpen ephemeral partisan talking points. This should be a very serious debate, a very much needed debate. We're in one of the greatest crises America has ever faced. If there are good faith amendments from the other side, we look forward to them. What we cannot do, however, is think small in the face of big problems. We cannot repeat the mistakes of the past. We cannot do too little. We cannot lock our country into a long and slow recovery. We must instead respond to the urgent needs in our country and chart a bold path back to normal.
That from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. In fact, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont tweeting out that his Republican lawmakers have more than 550 amendments. Expect a long evening and what will be a marathon session live on C-SPAN 2. Well, after promising another round of stimulus payments worth about $1,400 to most Americans, President Biden now signaling that he is open to restricting the number of people who would receive them based on their income. Democrats are reportedly considering sending the $1,400 payments to individuals earning up to $50,000 and $2,800 to married couples earning up to $100,000, plus the child credit of $1,400. Now, that's significant because it is a decrease from the first and second round checks, which included those earning up to $75,000 for individuals and $150,000 for couples. More on that story at WashingtonPost.com. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans continue to question the size of the COVID relief bill, with lawmakers hoping to slow things down by offering those amendments that we talked about just a moment ago. Here is Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
Last year, the Democratic leader kept saying we need a true bipartisan bill. He said, quote, sitting in your own office, writing a bill and then demanding the other side to support it is not anyone's idea of bipartisanship. That was the Democratic leader last year. Well, that was then. This is now. Now Democrats reject the bipartisan approach that built all five of our historic COVID packages. All five of them were bipartisan. So let's hope President Biden remembers the governing approach he promised and changes course. In the meantime, if we're to debate this phony partisan budget, we will create some clarity for the American people. We're going to put senators on the record. Expect votes to stop Washington from actively killing jobs during a recovery, like terminating the Keystone Pipeline. That job-killing, one-size-fits-all minimum wage hike, and whether to bar tax hikes on small businesses for the duration of this emergency. Expect votes that would help target this plan toward America's needs. Issues like stimulus checks for illegal immigrants, pouring money into schools where unions are blocking reopening, and the common sense step of delaying new spending until existing funds have actually gone out the door. We'll see what this resolution looks like on the other side and what signals Democrats send to the American people along the way.
And that from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. The debate over this stimulus bill does come at a time when the Senate, for the second time in 20 years, is evenly divided at 50-50. On our podcast, The Weekly, we talked to Sarah Binder. She is a Brookings Fellow, a George Washington University political science professor, about where the Senate is at this moment, and she offered some historical perspective.
50-50 Senates are very, very unusual, right? You reference back to 2001, but we'd have to go back more or less to the late 19th century. There was a case in 53. Senators kept dying right and left, and there's some independents, who one of whom crossed the aisle, changed his party, and so things were a little loosey-goosey there for a little while. But the last 50-50 Senate that stayed for a while, we would reach back to maybe the 1880s, early 1880s. So it's very unusual. Now, of course, we've had 51-seat majorities, 52-seat majorities, and those are also very hard. But 50-50 Senates are particularly, just because everything hangs, particularly in an increasingly partisan Senate where it's much harder to get senators from both parties to agree to various measures. It makes it all the harder on a 50-50 Senate, really, for the majority party to make a lot of progress.
Sarah Binder is our guest on C-SPAN's The Weekly. It's available wherever you get your favorite podcast. Joining us on the phone is Elena Treen. She covers Congress and the Biden administration for Axios.com. Let me begin with the Senate debate over the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Give us a sense of where things stand this evening.
That's right, Steve. They're in the process of passing a budget resolution, which will make the process of reconciliation easier. And essentially, it's a tool that allows Democrats, instead of having the 60 votes normally needed for any sort of regular legislation that goes through the Senate, it would allow them to pass it by a simple majority vote or 51 votes. And of course, Democrats would be more likely to pass that than they would a much larger bill. And so President Biden is still very eager to work with Republicans on this. And he keeps saying that he wants to make sure that they can reach some sort of compromise. But His team and also Democrats in conversations with him also recognize that they have priorities in there that they want to get done and that they have a tool that will allow them to do that. And so it's really unclear now what's going to happen, but Biden is still very much committed to some sort of compromise, and that's what Republicans are hoping that will end up happening.
In one of your pieces at Axios.com, Chuck Schumer is fast rediscovering the joys of running a 50-50 Senate with virtually no margin for error. He's dealing with stubborn centrist, irritated base, and uncooperative opposition. There's a lot there. Can you unpack it?
Yeah. Well, he's in a really tough spot. Yes, he is. He's 2 weeks in now to being the majority leader, but it's an entirely different Senate than when Mitch McConnell was running it. There's 50-50 tie, which means that it's a lot harder to jam through his priorities. He has to deal with varying degrees and different wings within the party. The moderates feel like they have immense power because, again, there's razor-thin majority in the Senate, but also President Biden is really committed to working with them and Republicans, and so they feel like they have a leg up and kind of bypass Chuck Schumer in getting things done with the White House. Progressives are also trying to pull him and the party to the left, and they have an agenda that they want to get done, and they think it's wait and see what happens with leader Schumer and whether he'll continue to kind of put their priorities first. Of course, Mitch McConnell is going to try and force him on a corner in many different issues. We saw that happen with the delay of the organizing resolution or the power sharing accord that kind of set up how the Senate would operate in this new 50-50 state. And then there's Republicans who are, of course, we saw this week when they went straight to President Biden to negotiate their own bill, and they're going to continue to try to skirt him in additional legislation, I think, in the weeks to come.
We're talking with Elena Treen of Axios, and not only is he facing pressure here in Washington, but as you point out, the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, also feeling it at home, whether it's Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Governor Andrew Cuomo. How so?
Well, New York is an interesting state, but of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York Congresswoman, very popular progressive, she's flirting with the idea of running for Senate in 2022, and Chuck Schumer's seat is up during the midterms. And so there's definitely a pull there and something that he needs to watch for if she does run. She's very popular. She has a ton of support. And so I think that he's definitely keeping an eye on her, and it could potentially shape how he acts on some issues as majority leader. And then Governor Cuomo has also been putting a lot of pressure on him, particularly with the stimulus bill and making sure that they get additional funding for state and local governments. He's been saying that they need more aid in New York and that he hopes that Leader Schumer will be able to deliver that for them, which is just another thing that he can add to his worries back home.
So let me bring it back to the president and Senate Republicans, because he had told GOP lawmakers that he has, quote, an open door and an open mind to their ideas. But are those just words, or is the White House committed to bipartisanship when it comes to this nearly $2 trillion coronavirus plan?
You know, Steve, I don't think they're just words, particularly when it comes to President Biden. He really is committed to bipartisanship, but this is a very tough bill to force through. Republicans do not want another $2 trillion package after this series that they of COVID bills that they saw over the past year. And so it is putting Joe Biden in a difficult place. I know that a lot of Republicans think that while the president himself seems to really want to compromise with them, they worry that Democratic lawmakers and even people within the White House who work for Biden are trying to pull him farther to the left. And so we're starting to see some of this play out more. I do think that we should have more answers soon on whether President Biden is willing to cave to certain demands. There's been talk of changing the threshold, the income threshold for the stimulus checks and also negotiations on other areas. And so if there is a deal, I know that President Biden and his team are hoping it'll still look a lot more like the deal that he had put forward and proposed originally. But I think we have to wait and see really how these negotiations play out.
Elena Treen, she covers the White House and Congress. Her work available at Axios.com here in Washington. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow rose 332, the NASDAQ was up 167, and the S&P gaining 41.5. Now the Democrats have control of the Senate committees. CNBC is reporting that the new chair of the Senate Finance Committee preparing to take on the super wealthy, dark money groups, and special interest organizations. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden saying tax reform is the number one priority for the committee. There was another attempt today to breach security near the U.S. Capitol. A statement from police stating that a female suspect arriving at a security checkpoint along New Jersey Avenue in D Street Southeast earlier today. She was told she could not enter the premises. The woman ignored the officer, attempted to drive through the checkpoint, and hit one of the officers in the process. She is being charged with assaulting a Capitol Hill police officer, assaulting with a deadly weapon, and unlawful entry. There are no reports of any serious injuries. You're listening to Washington Today. On this Thursday, February 4th, welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some of your other headlines. Earlier this week, former Vice President Mike Pence announcing he is opening an office in the D.C. area. Today, the Heritage Foundation announcing he will become a visiting senior fellow at the conservative think tank. And after weeks of speculation, CNN announcing that President Jeff Zucker will stay with the cable news channel until the end of this year. That is when his current contract expires. The network has seen an uptick in ratings since the election of Joe Biden as our 46th president. In what the White House is calling a major foreign policy speech, the president today announcing, quote, America is back, declaring diplomacy is at the center of U.S. foreign policy. He did so during remarks at the State Department with his new Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. The president announcing the U.S. will end all support for offensive operations in Yemen, will also appoint an envoy to focus on the longstanding conflict. And the New York Times with this headline, Biden freezing troops withdrawal of 12,000 troops from Germany, a process that was put in place by the Trump administration. It reads in part, quote, the move halting the Trump administration's decision to shift some units to Belgium and Italy and bring others home, a plan that rankled European leaders and angered lawmakers in both parties. More with the president at the State Department earlier today.
American alliances are our greatest asset. And leading with diplomacy means standing shoulder to shoulder with our allies and key partners once again. By leading with diplomacy, we must also mean engaging our adversaries and our competitors diplomatically, where it's in our interest and advance the security of the American people. That's why yesterday the United States and Russia agreed to extend the New START Treaty for 5 years. To preserve the only remaining treaty between our countries safeguarding nuclear stability. At the same time, I made it clear to President Putin, in a manner very different from my predecessor, that the days of the United States rolling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions, interfering with our elections, cyber attacks, poisoning its citizens, are over. We will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia and defend our vital interest and our people. And we will be more effective in dealing with Russia when we work in coalition and coordination with other like-minded partners. The politically motivated jailing of Alexei Navalny and the Russian efforts to suppress freedom of expression and peaceful assembly are a matter of deep concern to us and the international community. Mr. Navalny, like all Russian citizens, is entitled to his rights under the Russian Constitution. He's been targeted for exposing corruption. He should be released immediately and without condition.
The president earlier today joined by Vice President Kamala Harris, his remarks at the State Department. Democrats on the House Oversight Panel turning their attention to a Justice Department Inspector General report on his conclusion, finding that top Trump administration officials moved ahead with its zero tolerance policy, a policy that was put in place despite early concerns that it would separate families. The Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, telling members of the House Oversight and Reform Committee that it became apparent to the Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, that federal agencies were having a very hard time trying to reunite families after they were separated at the border under this policy. Now, that zero-tolerance policy was announced back in 2018. It essentially required all parents who crossed the border without authorization to be prosecuted for illegal entry. It was a misdemeanor, but they could not be charged and sentenced quickly enough to be reunited with their children. Here's more with the Justice Department IG, Michael Horowitz.
A review found that DOJ leadership failed to effectively prepare for or manage the implementation of the zero-tolerance policy. We concluded that the department's single-minded focus on increasing immigration prosecutions through the zero-tolerance policy came at the expense of careful and appropriate consideration of the impact of child separations. As we describe in our report, Attorney General Sessions understood that prosecution of family unit adults would result in children being separated from families, at least temporarily, and we determined that DOJ leadership was a driving force in DHS's decision to begin referring family unit adults for prosecution. We additionally concluded that DOJ leadership's expectations for how the family separation process would work significantly underestimated its complexities and demonstrated a deficient understanding of the legal requirements related to the care and custody of separated children. For example, Attorney General Sessions told the Southwest Board of U.S. Attorneys that prosecution of family unit adults would be swift and would be followed by immediate reunification of the separated family. However, federal law requires DHS to place separated children in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services within 72 hours. Completing a prosecution within such a timeline was, in most cases, a practical and legal impossibility, as the Southwest Board of U.S. Attorneys had effectively reported to DOJ headquarters. Yet, we determined that DOJ leadership did not take steps after receiving this information and learning about DHS's and HHS's difficulties in identifying the location of separated children to reconsider their prior assumptions about the ability to immediately reunify separated families. Additionally, we found that DOJ leadership did not effectively plan for or coordinate with the U.S. attorneys, the U.S. marshals, Health and Human Services, or the federal courts prior to announcing the new policy. Indeed, we determined that those key stakeholders were provided with little to no advance notice of either the zero tolerance policy or the decision to prosecute adult family unit members.
That update from the Inspector General for the Justice Department, RollCall.com, by the way, reporting that more than 5,000 children were separated from their parents at the border under the Trump administration policy. Well, the Senate continues the confirmation process, and today the president's nominee to head up the Labor Department. He was before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, often referred to as the HELP Committee. Senator Elizabeth Warren introducing the Boston Mayor, Marty Walsh, calling him, quote, a champion for unions while attracting corporations to Boston to create jobs. Kansas Senator Roger Marshall with this exchange with the Boston Mayor over the issue of a $15 minimum wage.
As I look at cost of living, median house in Boston, $600,000. The median house in my hometown of Great Bend is $83,000. The cost of living index in Boston is literally 2.2, a multiple of 2.2 from where I live. You have a minimum wage right now of $12?
Yeah, I think it's $12.78 maybe.
$12, the minimum wage in Great Bend is 7.25. So a $7 an hour job in Great Bend would be like a $16 an hour job in Boston, Massachusetts. I guess, you know, I'm trying to get at is how can we have a nationwide minimum wage of $15, which frankly would kill a lot of jobs in Kansas. So I'm all for if you want $15 an hour in Boston, knock your socks off. But in Kansas, that would be a pretty big wage, a job-killing wage.
Well, thank you, Senator. I think the issue around minimum wage is actually going to be debated on the Senate floor and the United States Congress floor. President Biden has stressed that he is supportive of a $15 an hour minimum wage, a national wage. I support him in that $15 an hour minimum wage, and I think that There's going to be many conversations from now till something passes the Senate and the House around conversations about how that, if in fact it passes, how does that $15 an hour minimum wage get instituted?
That from today's confirmation hearing for Marty Walsh and the exchange with Republican Senator from Kansas, Senator Marshall. He is, of course, President Biden's nominee to become the next Labor Secretary. And Marty Walsh, by the way, who joined the Laborers Union Local 223 at the age of 21. He served as the union president until he became the mayor of Boston back in 2014. More from today's Help Committee hearing. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're a union guy, and I think I have a lifetime 100% pro-union voting record. And I believe that if we're going to create a strong middle class in this country, we need to have a strong union movement. We need to make it impossible for employers to act illegally to prevent people from joining unions. Can you tell us what you, as Secretary of Labor, will do to allow working people in this country to exercise their constitutional right to join unions?
Well, I know that, thank you, Senator, for that question. I know that Chairwoman Murray mentioned today about the PRO Act that's going to be filed with her and Leader Schumer. That is one step towards helping union people to organize freely. I do believe in the right of organizing. I do believe in the right of people being able to join a union if they choose to join, if they want to join a union. So I certainly support that.
The confirmation hearing for the next Labor Secretary in the Biden administration, that's the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, in exchange with Senator Bernie Sanders. Meanwhile, the Senate's top Democrat, Chuck Schumer, joined with Senator Elizabeth Warren and other leading Democrats, reintroducing a resolution, again calling on the White House to forgive $50,000 in student debt for all borrowers by executive action. At this Capitol Hill news conference, here is Senator Warren.
Canceling student loan debt is the single most effective executive action that President Biden can take to kickstart this economy. Canceling student loan debt is the single most effective executive action that President Biden can take to help close the racial wealth gap. Canceling student loan debt is the single most effective executive action President Biden can take to lift the economic prospects of tens of millions of young Americans. Data show that canceling the student loan debt would result in greater home ownership rates, more housing stability, improved credit scores, higher incomes, higher GDP, more small business formation, and more jobs. Canceling student loan debt is good for you, whether you have student loan debt or not, because it is good for our economy. Canceling student loan debt would help close the black-white wealth gap by 28 points for African Americans and by a similar number for Latinos. Again, the single most effective action that the President of the United States can take. 45 million Americans, that's one in every five adults in this nation, is dealing with student loan debt. We cancel $50,000 of student loan debt, and we lift the prospects, we lift the future of all Americans. So I am honored to be here today with my partners from the House and my partner in the Senate, Leader Schumer. We're going to get this done.
That was Senator Warren, joined by congressional Democrats, an issue she campaigned on back in 2020. Now, by the numbers, canceling $50,000 for all borrowers would shrink the country's outstanding student loan debt to a balance of about $700 billion. Right now, it is at $1.7 trillion. The message of the 2021 National Prayer Breakfast can be summed up in these words: no future without forgiveness. President Joe Biden calling on a confrontation of the political extremism that inspired the U.S. Capitol riot. He appealed for collective strength during the turbulence. This year, the breakfast, because of COVID, became a virtual event. Here's President Biden.
Over 400,000 of our fellow Americans have lost their lives to a deadly virus. Millions are out of work. We see long lines for food at food banks that stretch for miles. We hear the call for racial justice, some 400 years in the making, And we know the dream, and more importantly, the reality of justice for all cannot be deferred any longer. We see the existential threat of climate crisis that poses to our planet and everywhere we turn, with more severe floods, stronger hurricanes, more intense wildfires. We just have to open our eyes. We've just witnessed images that we've never imagined, images that now we'll never forget. A violent assault on the U.S. Capitol, on our assault on our democracy, on our Capitol, a violent attack that threatened lives and took lives. And we know now we must confront and defeat political extremism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism. For so many in our nation, this is a dark, dark time. So where do we turn? Faith. Kierkegaard wrote, "Faith sees best in the dark." I believe that to be true. For me, in the darkest moments, faith provides hope and solace, provides clarity and purpose as well. It shows the way forward. As one nation in a common purpose, to respect one another, to care for one another, to leave no one behind.
From today's National Prayer Breakfast, again held virtually because of the pandemic, former President Jimmy Carter sending a written message of prayer, and there were video messages from former Presidents Clinton, Obama, and this from George W. Bush.
One of the highlights of the presidency was attending the National Prayer Breakfast every year. In 2001, following the 9/11 attacks, prayer helped heal and unite our nation. Prayer is the language of reconciliation. It has the vocabulary of grace, love, and peace our country needs to move forward together. As president, there was no greater gift than the prayers of the American people. Laura and I often pray for our country and for those who serve it, and we will continue to do so. May God bless you all, and may God bless America.
That from former President George W. Bush, participating virtually in the National Prayer Breakfast, a tradition that dates back to the 1950s during the Eisenhower administration. And with the former presidents participating today, one notable absent, that of former President Donald Trump. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And all of our coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully. Hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.